Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data.
And I'm Lee Harper, AI human with coming on 11 years now doing AI bits and pieces. And today we're joined by Laura Armino from Sabre. Very interesting set of topics for you today. One of the big ones towards the end, we'll be talking about how she's really taken a bunch of the Gen AI initiatives to Sabre and been able to put some better quantification and accuracy around those initiatives, a problem that's been plaguing many enterprises over the last couple of years since GPT came around. So welcome, Laura. We're excited to have you. Please introduce yourself to us.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. My name is Laura Palomino. I'm a lead data informatics at Sabre. I have over 10 years of data analytics and software engineering, and I specialize in bridging technology and business to drive impactful results using AI and advanced data.
And just for a bit of context, because obviously we've heard of Sabre, but maybe not all of our listeners have. So what does Sabre do in a couple of lines?
So Sabre empowers the travel industry. So airlines, hoteliers, booking, anything of the sort, in high level is what Sabre is.
And so you have access to lots of data.
A lot of data. Sabre's sitting on a lot of data.
Laura, one of the interesting things about your journey into the AI space, because we all have at this point in time a different journey, is you've come from being a more traditional software engineer in your past to seeing a bunch of challenges and then wanting to learn and be involved in machine learning and AI to overcome some of those. Tell us a bit about your journey, how you started out and how that transitionary period looked for you.
So what initially drew me into engineering, technology and software engineering was the sheer potential of technology solving complex problems very efficiently. But what truly sparked my interest when it came to artificial intelligence and machine learning is just seeing organizations, including my own, how often they get stuck in a reactive approach to problem solving. So I noticed many teams dealing with the same issues every day or spending hours on tedious and repetitive tasks with no clear path to innovation. Like many other companies, we have a ton of valuable data. We're sitting on goldmine, but unfortunately, it's spread across different silos, making it hard to access when we actually really need it. All of this made me wonder, why not use this data more efficiently? Why not shift from a reactive problem to a proactively solving them before they age? So that's when I realized how powerful machine learning and AI could be. And that's when I became very motivated to explore how these tools could help us work smarter, not harder.
I think everyone sees it or hears about it is it's very easy to feel busy, right? It's very easy to do lots of small tasks, minutiae, and feel, oh, I'm being really productive because I'm filling out my spreadsheet every single day, the same spreadsheet. But of course, to your point, that kind of holds back the innovation side.
Laura, you probably experienced this when you were first getting into data and machine learning and everything. All of this is the ease of asking that next question, but you have to actually think of the questions or have questions to begin with. Like back to what you just said about being very busy. I remember my first data job way back in the day at Dell. I was taking over somebody else's like kind of portfolio of data products that they were doing. And it was weird to him that I asked him when looking at all this stuff, I was like, oh my gosh, this looks like a bunch of busy work. I don't want to do this. Well, I wasn't thrilled about it. And I said, who's looking at this? I don't know. I didn't ask that. How often are they looking at it? Why are they looking at it? Do they still want it? And they found out that 75% of the workflow he was doing, nobody even knew he was delivering any. So Laura, I bet you probably found some of that in your journeys too.
A lot. People will get so busy just doing this repetitive task that they had no room for innovation. They had no room to go be more proactive and do something else with their time, except just deal with this repetitive task. That specifically is what drew me in to help them out, because once I automated this task for them, not only did they think because of those tedious work that they were doing, but they went off and started teaching their teams how to be more innovative and start using technology to keep moving forward.
So what do you see? Because software engineering can automate things. AI ML can also automate things, maybe a different set of things. How do you see that kind of connection between those two? And how have you applied software and or ML techniques to help people out?
So luckily, I started as a software engineer. That's what has really helped me through my journey. I learned how to automate things day one or since I graduated from college. learning constantly the new technologies that come out really motivated me to, as we spoke about, helping people being stuck doing tedious work for hours. I can't tell how many times I've helped people go from spreadsheet to spreadsheet doing hours of work to just being automated and then them being able to do other projects or doing something else with their time. So yes, having that foundation of technology really did help me, and which made it easier moving and transitioning to AI, because I already knew how to automate data, clean data, do ETLs, et cetera. And then when it came to switching to AI, it was just learning Python or the different technologies that including doing machine learning and AI to successfully implement it.
So what did that look like? You've worked at big orgs. So what did that look like switching inside your organization from more software dev to AI? How did the org support you in that kind of shift, that journey?
One of the things I truly appreciate about my company is the environment of innovation they foster. Sabre provides numerous opportunities for employees to bring new ideas to life through initiatives like hackathons, big pitch, whatever it is. And it's actually open for everyone across the company, not just technologists. And on top of that, what made it even easier for us is our partnership with Google, right? It's so invaluable. And since we're partners with Google, we get the opportunity to use their tools to firsthand learn the AI tools that come out, the brand new things, and implement it how we want them, whether it's in a sandbox or a testing environment that is given to us. So much room for trial and error, so much room for innovation that our company gives us.
I think that's a very important point you bring up, is like that we have seen a lot of companies open up or lean more towards opening up hackathons and idea generation from people, but sometimes the scope of it might not be as broad as what you just mentioned. The scope might be IT, but as you just said, that's an important caveat that you just mentioned, is that it's open to anybody, where like the people closest to the operations, to the business, to the customer, have very important insights into innovation.
It makes a huge difference too, because again, technologists, not technologists, business partners, whatever, can get together in a team mm-hmm. and build this amazing idea and bring it to life. And honestly, the reason I actually came out with one of my first machine learning projects, what motivated me to continue was I entered these hackathons or this big pitch, and it made me continue and do better with the support of Google, our partners, and obviously Sabre to continue with this project.
So that gives us a very nice and natural segue to talking about your first project that you ever did. So why don't you tell us a little bit, to the level that you can, about what that was, how you went about as a person new to this space, what was your method like going to that first project? And then we'll obviously come back to how your methods evolved over many projects in a little bit.
Yes, of course. My first machine learning project, it was centered around developing a system to predict whether a software update, a new feature, or any change that went into production will cause a client impact, essentially a pass or fail system. So my motivation behind this idea came from several challenges I already spoken from here and that I just kept observing. So first of all, when a client impact occurs, teams often scramble to get the right people on the call and, of course, pinpoint the issues as quickly as possible. Second, having a client down doesn't just disrupt operations. It can lead also to losing customer trust and a hit on our reputation. And finally, extended downtime can result in very costly SLAs violation, which is something every company just strives to avoid, right? In addition to the specific factors I just mentioned, our organization deals with 300 up to sometimes 1,000 changes a day. So just imagine trying to monitor all of these changes manually by teams such as SREs, incident managements, developers, etc. It's incredibly challenging, and a risk of missing something critical is high. So by predicting potential issues before they occur, my main goal or goals were to minimize disruption in downtime while also preventing those very costly SLA violations.
How did you choose that as like the thing you wanted to look into? One of the things we talked about a while back is that there's a whole bunch, like Sabre's a huge company. There's lots of opportunity. Now, I think you mentioned several very important criteria, like this is software that changes customer experience, your customer's customer, the things like, but I imagine also that you had a wealth of opportunity on what you could have looked at. So is it like that familiarity from your software dev background? What kind of drove you to pick this particular topic?
It definitely started as in my technology background as being a software engineer. I would develop software for my application. I will create a change ticket. write down exactly what I was doing, and then automatically deploy it in production. So I know the process. I know exactly what happens. I know the teams that are involved in incident management, change management, the whole nine, right? So mm-hmm. when I came into Sabre, I came more into the analytical side. I saw the change, how not just my changes, but how the whole company as a whole changes, goes, all of them goes into production.
So with this kind of project, this was your first project. I have plenty of battle scars from my early AI projects. How did you approach this from a project perspective? As someone who obviously was experienced with software but new to data science, what was your kind of approach and method that you took to trying to solve this problem?
I went from software engineers to analytics. And when I went to analytics, I started seeing the big picture of how this data was, what it looks like, how it was affecting the teams, and how was it affecting production. I noticed that there were a lot of client impacts by specific, whatever, teams, configuration items, whatever. And I started to, what I thought was a pattern. Okay, maybe around these hours, maybe around this time of the week is when they either fail the most or they don't. And then when machine learning and AI came along, I was like, God, if I can just predict an issue before it happens, it can save everyone so much time. People wouldn't, the incident managers would know who to have on call right there and then. And we'll just have everyone ready. And mean time to recover, if there is an incident, will be reduced.
You probably hit a lot of things like, actually, let me say it this way. You could probably have started a company around just that very idea.
I was a developer. I was like, I just have one change, two changes a month of my enhancement. But these people dealing with 300 plus to 1,000 a day. I mean, if I could help them out somehow to pinpoint, okay, here's like the top 10 that are probably going to fail. Mm-hmm. Put the teams on. Hey, don't let them deploy something to the point that could help prevent these issues, prevent the SLAs, prevent the incident. That was my goal. That was my passion to start in this project.
So what kind of level of accuracy or level of effectiveness did this have to really achieve to be a useful? Because we can build many models. All models have error rates. What the old phrase, right? All models are wrong. Some models are useful. What was the kind of criteria for this to be a useful model for the company?
So in my opinion, for this to have been a useful model for our team members would have been like at least 75 to at least 80% accuracy on the prediction. Unfortunately, as I kept going on with this project, one of the biggest challenges I encountered was related to data quality. Now, while I had data,
the classic.
I know, right? While I had substantial amounts of data, unfortunately, not all of it was reliable or consistent. And of course, the inconsistency of this data is what hindered the model. It's just so crucial for machine learning models, which is any models, to be trained in highly accurate data. As we all heard before, garbage in, garbage out. So despite training everything, throwing the kitchen sink at this model, applying all the data science standards, the techniques such as data cleaning, normalizing data, anything I can think of, the model's performance unfortunately plateaued at exactly 51%. And while the model was predicting client impacts, it was very cool to see before they happened, maybe not for the company. It was unfortunately also crimeable, leading to a false alarms. And in my opinion, it wouldn't have been appropriate to roll out this system that triggered unnecessary alerts for the teams. They have so much to deal with already. Imagine just throwing just not a reliable system.
That's always the thing, right? It's hard to know in advance. Even with a great idea, will the data quality, will the data completeness support the level of accuracy, that measure of effectiveness that we need to get it be production ready? Interesting question, though, the one that I have here is, if plateaued somewhere, I'm guessing this model didn't get to production, how do you know when to stop? Because data science is about experimentation, ML is about experimentation. We're always pushing the boundary. It's all a lot of bleeding edge stuff. But there comes a point where it's like, enough's enough. This isn't going to go. We should do something different or pivot. And that can be really hard just in general to figure out. So how did you go about figuring that out in this case? When to stop?
I realized when to stop when the model's performance had plateaued, right? Because it's actually started really low, like 10%. And then as I kept doing things, adding more data, adding more tuning, whatever, it kept going up and up. So I had high hopes. I was like, okay, I can make this go up. When it plateaued, I just decided to take a step back and assess the situation. It became so clear to me that the underlying issue with the data quality was more significant than I initially thought. And this needs to be addressed before I can continue making any progress. So rather than pushing forward with no success with this deficient model, I made a difficult decision to pause the project and focus on working with the different teams to improve this data. Because I know in the future, this is still a goal. We're still trying to prevent incident from happening. So if we can just make this data better, which we are at the moment, actually, then whatever AI you throw at it is actually going to do a good job in predicting things.
It's frequently one of the things that we coach our clients on is that sometimes when you hit these plateaus, seek the win in the plateau, right? Because in this case, what your model uncovered was the opportunity for Sabre to potentially standardize certain processes across dev teams, capture, they maybe people thought they were capturing certain telemetry about the dev process, and then your model uncovered the fact that they weren't. There's n number of things that it could be, but then by you provided empirical proof about breaks or gaps in the knowledge, right? And in cases where like the outcome of predicting these things is really important and preventing these things is really important, then now you have been able to quantify a value in pursuing these standardizations. Because most people, like if you look at it, like most people would want that quality data or would want the standardization of the process, but they've never been able to really, they may have not from their position be able to articulate the benefit in doing that. And so we tell data scientists like frequently their opportunity is you can help quantify the benefit that we could get out of a standard process or standard data or over here, whereas like these people feel the pain of it. So it's probably, hopefully people are all happy with the lack of standards or things that your model pointed out that it's been beneficial for their lives versus detrimental.
Well, for sure. And honestly, doing this project with the different teams, we all actually noticed a lot of different patterns from the data. We noticed that, hey, you know what? On Thursdays, on the first couple of weeks of the or first week of the month, there's a lot of more failed changes than there is at the end of the month or Wednesday, stuff like that. That if I didn't dig into this data like that, we wouldn't have realized. So just a lot of cool things like that we realized about the data as we were doing this project.
So probably nobody was stocking the break room with coffee on those Thursdays, and that's what happened. The vendor contract ran out. No coffee was delivered. Everybody's tired. Really bad codes getting delivered. And they're like, you know what? We messed up. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm sure you have great break room vendors. So not disparaging your break room vendors at all. It is funny what we can find sometimes when you see patterns like that.
And typically,
typically
people looking at the data in this way and to start doing like data science initiatives, because data science comes in with a different lens, a different perspective to say some other more traditional, say BI or analytical techniques. Not better, not worse, just different.
I mean, seeing data, seeing all the opportunities that you can do to help the company, help your colleagues, is what motivates a lot of us to do what we do.
So as you've done more projects and you've gained more experience, my last question on this first project is, if you were to do this project again, if you were to start this project from scratch today, given what you know now compared to what you knew then, how would you approach it? What would you tell Laura 2 years ago about the project? And would it be the same? Would it be different? How would you revisit it?
I realized that from this project that building the model is just one part of the challenge. Ensuring its accuracy and its reliability is just equally important, if not more. In this case, while the model could predict client impacts, again, cool, it also triggered too many false positives, which made the model unusable. So the experience taught me that the importance of fine-tuning and validation, especially when real-time decision-making is involved. So this had influenced my current project right now by pushing me to dig deeper into the data quality and model evaluation, which is actually one of the biggest projects I'm working on at the moment, is regarding accuracy and model evaluation. So I'm glad I did this project. It taught me a lot of things and it pushed me forward to the current project that I'm working right now in AI.
Then let's move on to that next then. Because obviously generative AI is the hot topic du jour. It's on everyone's mind. And people are spending a lot of money on Gen AI. And often, as we're reading in the press, getting not much return for their investment yet. I'm sure it'll come, but it's early days yet. So yeah, tell us a bit about what you're working on and in this space and how it's impacting the company and impacting you.
Our partnership with Google is invaluable. We fortunately get to use their new tools, and one of them be the generative AI tools. So our first generative AI project that was created was for our need for more proactive intelligence on the incident management system. So traditional methods of examining through hundreds of knowledge articles or documents and based on historical incidents is very time consuming and often inefficient in urgent situations. So technologies such as Gen AI provided us with the ability to quickly analyze vast amounts of data, identify patterns, and surface relevant information in real time. So my goal for this specific project that we're actually currently working on is to allow the operations team to respond more efficiently to incidents. For example, when a new incident occurs, the chatbot can identify similar past incidents, offer potential solutions, and pull in insights from post-mortem documents in real time, on the fly and when we really need it, which is what the current problem is. We're all trying to scramble to get data, but if you have a chatbot, say, hey, I have this problem with a specific client and it's happened before, boom, you get your resolution that fixed the problem back then.
This is one of the awesome things I see with projects like what you just did, Laura, is that we can have a positive reinforcement of things that, like, and this is the example of like agile practices. So practices that are good, but we couldn't always realize the benefit from. So like retrospectives in agile have been something very common. Find me prior to Gen AI, find me agile teams that properly use Gen AI, and I will find you a dinghy that will hold all of it, right? Because there's just not that many. Now, with projects like what you just did, we can now more easily go to the value of a documented retrospective, documented like incidents. Because it's not that those ideas weren't valuable, they're very valuable ideas, but like the cost to search all past incidents, the cost to search, the friction it introduces is high. And now you're solving for that friction. And so we have this opportunity to put a very positive feedback loop in place, whereas like, hey, this idea for retrospectives, for properly documenting cases is good. And now Laura and people like Laura have made it easier to use this data. So we can use this data. People can see value out of doing the retrospective because of things that you build. They'll probably do it better and more often. So are you seeing that at Sabre? You've made it easier to surface past incident data and past retrospective data. Is it reinforcing better behavior from the teams?
It's getting the teams extremely excited because there are, as you mentioned, hundreds of postmortem documents out there and thousands of incidents. And sometimes some of the issues that happen have happened before. And so when you type in the model and then we're actually putting the model in Teams because everyone at our company uses Teams. Hey, I need to figure out this real quick. Let me type into Teams, get the answer, and then solve the problem as quickly as possible. It's just very exciting to see.
When you've got a model, this incident knowledge base model, it's easy to build these models. We can get them up and running, but quantifying their success or otherwise can be somewhat more difficult. What methods are you using to try and evaluate how successful, how good these models are in the generative AI space at doing what they're supposed to be doing?
So one of the common challenges we saw throughout the organization is, including ourselves, right, is our Gen AI models were giving answers, but we didn't have a way to know if they were actually correct or not, or if there were any hallucinations. And at the moment, the company has over 40 plus generative AI projects in the company that we needed to a reliable way to measure if the model is having things right, if the performance is actually correct. One of the first things we did was develop a regression test. This test checks if the model can match responses to our knowledge base articles or not. If it does, we consider it a positive match. And if it doesn't, then it's marked as negative. When we're doing this test, we automatically send 200 questions to the model. The model replies with answers that didn't match. So that would be a positive. What will count as a negative is if the model will say, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. So that will be marked as a negative. Okay, so the ones that are marked positive, that doesn't mean those responses are correct. It just means that it found a match on the knowledge articles. So that's why the second phase came in. That's why I implemented an AI-driven way called BERT, Bidirectional Encoder Representation from Transformers. It's a bit of a mouthful. Now, what does BERT do? BERT lets us capture a deeper semantic correctness between the agent responses and the ground truths more accurately. The most current version of using a BERT is great at spotting paraphrases, different ways of saying the same thing. It's like having a translator who ensures that no matter how the question is phrased, it gets the answer spot on. So, for example, we had, my main drive to do this as well is because we had 200 questions sent to the model and then it replied with answers. Okay, great. We had 10 plus people having to check these 200 questions manually, even though they have 1,000 things to do. So what BERT does is what these people are doing. It checks the correctness of the answer, whether it is hallucinated or incorrect, or we actually question correctly. So even though out of the 200 questions, it's a positive 99.1%, BERT told us correct percentage and positive was 89%, which, I mean, still really good for a model. It was still really good, but it wasn't 99%. It was actually 89%. And so what that does is take away those 15 people, put them back their time, be more proactive somewhere else. And instead of them checking 200 questions, it's narrowed down to what it sounds like, only 10%. Check those small questions to see, okay, why was the answer inaccurate? Why was it hallucinating?
So is this anticipated to be something that will be used by all these 40 projects? Is it specific to this one? How's that looking from a wider perspective?
So actually, ever since we incorporated this, both of these steps, this two-phase system, a lot of teams started to realize that, hey, we can use this to test our accuracy on our models, whether it's a high-level regression test or using BERT to check the accuracy of the answers compared to the agents, to what the agent is responding. And it's been such a fun experience because we're not just doing it for our project, but we're spreading and helping the other teams test their accuracy as well.
How have you been going about helping other teams incorporate your work and your learnings and findings into their own work from that kind of cultural perspective, that adoption perspective? How have you been approaching that?
So we've been doing presentations of how our regressional tests and BERT work through different teams, which kind of spread the word around that this is here to be able to help other teams to test the accuracy of their models. And again, up to this morning that we had a town hall that we were able to show a bigger audience that this technology is now available for them to use. So don't recreate the wheel. We've started something, and obviously anybody's ideas or incorporation that they want to add to it, great. But at least we have something that will help these other Gen AI models get their performance.
It sounds like, Laura, because Sabre already had the idea of pulling people together for hackathons, that there was like a venue pre-existing for you to talk about your successes. Like, how important have you found those that's one thing we can see with some of our other clients. They may not have those venues. They may not have created those cultural processes, but have you found that has increased knowledge and collaboration by the existence of town halls and other things to spread these ideas? What's been the impact for your project success by having these kind of pre-existing ways that people collaborate?
It's been a huge, it's actually the reason why the opportunity to create these different Gen AI models to begin with exploded. Everyone started getting these ideas of, whoa, wait, how can you this amount of data deal with daily, come up with the idea of how to automate it and then put it in a hackathon or in a competition. Mm-hmm. And out of that came out a lot of great ideas, a lot of Gen AI ideas, machine learning that actually went into production. But it made a huge difference. Like, our culture, Sabre has one best culture overall, and I can see why. Look at all the things they're doing for us to learn and grow and consistently develop our ideas if we have any, and we have so much leadership, executive support to be able to bring any innovation we have to light.
And honestly, 40 Gen AI products, even for a large firm, that's a lot at this stage in the game to be doing. So the fact that there's obviously the confidence to have that many different people and teams working on it simultaneously also indicates that, right? A lot of firms are a bit cagier, should we say, than that about adopting it. So that's good. So what's next? What's Laura working on today? What's she working on tomorrow? Kind of what are you excited about in the near future in this space?
So at the moment, we're actually trying to put both Kaizen and regression testing into a platform where it makes it easier for new different Gen AI projects to come in and just start using it. Mm-hmm. Start using, hey, let me evaluate my performance on my Gen AI. Let me test how it's doing when we go from Gemini 1.0 to Gemini 1.5 Flash real quick, make sure nothing broke or is actually answering correctly. that's a huge chunk of work trying to create that platform.
And that is often the piece that people don't realize is building the model, and you've already mentioned this earlier on, is this not the biggest part of the project, right? The data quality, the data, but also its deployment. And then it's once it's deployed, of course, then someone's got to maintain it, right? So someone's got to make sure that it's staying relevant, that all the new use cases are also working with it. But I guess that's also where your software engineering background comes in, because you have the experience of building robust systems, I'm sure, maintaining them as well. So
exactly. And automatically deploying the systems into production automatically. That is what we're working on right now. And it's very challenging, right? Because at the moment, our team is very small and we have to partner up with a bunch of different people to be able to accomplish this. But now, since we have so much attention and there's so much attention of what we're doing and how it can help other people, of course, we're going to get that.
We're really excited for your career, for the ideas that you've had. So anything else that you're studying next, whether it's Google or more on the GCP, more on the ins and outs of GCP, but what is Laura reading and studying today?
Like many technologists, I'm constantly watching the evolution of generative AI or how technology evolves, how it can potentially transform everything with data. However, though, we should be skeptical about the ethical implications and potential biases in the AI models, which do need to be addressed and ensure fair and accurate outcomes. I've heard a couple of things regarding like how models can be biased or unethical, and that's something that we watch for as well, and constant reading and learning. So like we mentioned before, Gen AI topic, there's just so much to it, and it just keeps evolving. You never stop learning. Every other week, we're learning new things. I've been constantly upgrading my BERT model to check the performance of the Gen AI models. It hasn't just been one. I've been consistently upgrading it to a new and improved one that actually checks those answers more accurately.
No rest. It's always moving. Laura, it's been fun having you all. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so fun talking about this topic. It motivates me. It gets me excited. I'll let you guys know what I come out with next.